marketing is about value. This is a very complicated world. It's a very noisy world. And we're not going to get a chance to get people to remember much about us. No company. And so we have to be really clear on what we want them to know about us.
How are you, man?
Good. Are you recovered?
Starting to get a bit better. Cheers.
Oh, look, peak.
Yeah.
One way of drinking that.
Got my serotonin mood drink.
Very nice. Now what do we do?
First of all, the guests might arrive in a minute. In this episode, we're going to talk to Danielle, who's the founder and CEO of Flight Performance, who's part of the company called Flight Story, which you might know of from the famous Stephen Bartlett, and Oliver Yonchev. He had an agency doing performance marketing. And earlier this year, Stephen Bartlett's company acquired his agency. So he's part of the Flight Story group now. He's based in LA. So I think it's going to be a very interesting chat. I want to ask him about that, the agency, like growing his agency, meeting with Stephen, and you know, going through the acquisition, and what does that mean for him now? And then maybe we can ask him a little bit about the state of play of marketing from his side, from the West Coast in the US, you know, like what are things popping at the moment, you know, like get a bit of, download a bit of his brain on that side of things. Yeah, that should be a good one. There you go, perfect timing. Hey, Daniel.
Hey.
How's it going, man?
All good?
Good.
All good, how are you?
I'm good, yeah. Coming out of Black Friday, Cyber Monday craziness, but it was a pretty good one for us, actually, so I'm pretty happy.
You're still alive, so that's good. It's a good sign.
Yeah. Honestly, it was... I was just talking to my team about it. I mean, it's only our third as the agency, because I've only done 3 years, but... by far the smoothest in 3 years, by far.
Wow.
And even actually, like Chris was saying, it's his 10th in an agency, and he was like, it's by far his smoothest as well. So I guess we've got to be grateful for that.
That's good.
Well done.
You're doing something right, obviously.
I don't know why. Maybe we just planned, really.
Maybe you're good. Maybe you have a good agency going.
I don't know about that.
One of those.
Agencies suck, right?
No comment.
Because we already met Daniel in your podcast a few months ago, but Daniel, this is Jake.
Awesome and to meet you, Jake.
This is Daniel. Yeah.
I enjoy the pod. I'm a subscriber, and I enjoy the pod. And then I steal some of your little tips and tricks about how to get more viewers on it. I was just recording it and posting it previously, just thinking, whatever. But you guys are teaching me how to actually grow it. So I appreciate you for that.
Oh man, that's good to hear. Oh, you know, how is yours going? It's Bite Sized, right? That's the name.
Yeah, it's going good. I started doing a newsletter alongside the actual podcast as well recently, which
nice.
It's good, but. Fucking hell. Like,
just add more work, right?
I love writing and I write a lot of content, don't get me wrong, but having to sit there every Sunday and think, I've got to write this newsletter. And it's a challenge, but I kind of enjoy it. I do enjoy the medium, but that's going well. So yeah, it's all going good. I mean, I'm only at like 22 episodes or something.
Yeah.
But next year... I've built out a little in-person studio in LA to do... I won't be able to do every one of them in person because otherwise it limits the guests. So yeah, it's going well. It's going well. I'm sure you're the same, but like your aspirations of what it could become elevate as you get more and more traction.
Yeah.
And I feel like, I feel like then I'm like, oh shit, the quality needs to constantly elevate with it. But at the same time, realizing I've only done 22 of them. So, you know, it's gonna take a while. And I think the pressure of, well, not pressure, but being business partners and friends of Stephen Bartlett, who has the second biggest in the world, is like, fuck off.
It's I don't know if it's a good pressure to have or just completely demoralizing because it's just so far gone.
It's a bit of both. It's a bit of both. Yeah. But you know, at the same time, his podcast team is bigger than my agency. Well, not quite actually, but he has like 35 people on his podcast team. And just the level of standards that go into it, and just seeing how it operates is pretty phenomenal. He always reminds me he was like posting for 2 years before he got past 10,000 subscribers. So
I was going to say that took him a while, didn't it?
Take some comfort in that.
Exactly. And it remind me, the podcast, is it separate from your agency or is it part of like the content engine of the agency as well?
No, it's totally separate.
Totally separate.
Yeah. I mean, I say it's totally separate. I've only just set it up as a separate company. Because I got, I managed to get Motion to sponsor it, but we use them in the agency. Initially, it was just like, I wanted to put a name to it. I didn't want it to be part of the agency. And now I'm really glad I made that decision because, you know, I'm sure the same as you. I think it could actually become something worthwhile. You know, I have aspirations of, you know, really building it out with the newsletter, potentially even helping others with their podcasts. Potentially even buying additional newsletters, just a media company, probably the same as you.
Yeah,
exactly. The same.
Like, why not? Why not?
Starts off being a podcast, and then within 10 minutes, it's like a media company, and we're going to be doing this start a newsletter tonight.
I mean, I feel like if you don't have that aspiration, like, why not have that aspiration?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Why not?
It at least holds you to like a higher standard of thinking. So, we'll see. We'll see.
No, it is pretty good. It's very exciting to do. I think the number one thing that we remind ourselves is that the number one is just posting every week. Like, forget everything else. Like, we might, like you said, like, put some more pressure on us and be like increasing the quality or whatever it is. But at the end of the day, it's like, ignore all this. Like, all you have to do is just post every week, turn up, show up, and do it for 2 years, 2-3 years, and then eventually, you know, we'll get to some decent size. We spoke to people who actually don't even look at their stats as well.
Yeah.
And we're not like that because I'm obsessed. Like, I look at it way too closely and I freak out when we have a bad day. And I'm like, why are not people listening? And I'm like, it's bad, you know? So, but you've got the two side of the coin, you know? Like, some people just do it and they do it for a year. They don't even look at any numbers. Yeah. So,
yeah. I try and avoid looking at the numbers, if I'm honest with you, because I'd get too obsessed and over analytical.
Yeah.
And I have to remember I've got an agency to run at the same time.
And the hardest thing is that, like, all the stuff that we do, all of us do in our day to day marketing, podcasts, you cannot see like half as much as you can see on any other channel. So it just makes drives you crazy. You're like, where are these listeners coming from? We've had a huge peak and you just have no insight into any of that stuff. So it's not actionable in any way. So you might as well just not bother looking.
No. One of the main things I know is that a lot of my listeners also like Drake, which is fucking great.
It's useful, We just need to get him on as a guest. That's all this time.
And they come from somewhere in the world.
And they come from somewhere in the world. We were just talking about the Spotify Wrapped. We just got the Spotify Wrapped for podcasters. Got that version of it. We'll probably share some of it like in the next few days. That was pretty cool to see like how many people have us in their like top 10, top 5, and like number and their favorite like number one podcast.
Yeah, that's
amazing. Was pretty cool.
That's really good.
Some validation that there is something happening after 6 months of doing it. But anyway, let's wind back. Tell us who you are, Daniel. Like, the a little intro. Like, you know, who are you, and what do you do in LA?
I'm Daniel. I run Flight Performance, which is a performance agency based in Los Angeles, part of Stephen Bartlett and Oliver Yonchev's Flight Story Group. We're a growth agency, really specializing in growth strategy, creative strategy, paid media, lifecycle marketing, and web experiences. Work with mainly e-commerce brands, some tech, some SaaS companies, lead generation, but probably about 70% kind of consumer facing. We skew largely fashion, mainly because I like fashion, and so that's a lot of what my network is, which is fun. And then I've been in the industry for a long time. I joined MySpace in 2004, so kind of part of the social explosion at a really, I say young age. I was relatively young back then, but kind of one of the starting things. So I was at MySpace for a couple of years. That's when I first came to LA. Obviously, I'm not from here. And I made it my life's goal at that point of if I was able to one day move to LA and run my own company, then that was the holy grail for me. So managed to do that, which is kind of cool.
What's the next life goal?
What's the next goal?
Yeah.
Retire and move to Japan.
Oh man, I've got the same goal. That's funny.
Or at least visit Japan.
Why Japan?
You know, I don't know, it's one of these strange things. I just have a real affinity and love for the culture, even though I've never been there. Japanese art, I love kind of Japanese philosophy and good fashion sense, good style, great food. Again, from not having been there, so not really authentic Japanese.
You're gonna love it then.
Yeah.
You should feel like we're very similar. I've been twice, and genuinely, I'm not even joking. One of my goals before I retire, or like when I retire, or whenever, when I can, I actually want to buy a house there and just being able to like just go there for a month or 2 months every year, like as a place to be. But it's amazing. Yeah. You should definitely go.
I definitely want to. It's really good. Let's chip in on a house one day and we can we can timeshare.
Should we do like timeshare, a third? Jake, you jump in as well, and then we do it's fine. Nice. Just leave me the spring, so it's the best season, then you can go anywhere else.
That's definitely a bucket list. I was just to finish that off at MySpace, then I joined AOL. AOL when they were still doing big things. Great company. I was there for a couple of years. Yeah. Strategy across their owned and operated properties and their performance network. Mm. And then I joined a company called Turn, which was a programmatic DMP, DSP, digital social agency, but also kind of had the ad tech behind it as well. And it was at that point where programmatic was new. Right. And it was the new way to buy social. It was the new way to do performance marketing. So it was, I know these days it's got a bit of a different connotation, a bit of a race to the bottom. But at the time it was like really exciting because MySpace learned all about social. AOL learned more about brand marketing. Then Turn was like my foray into true kind of like DR marketing, programmatic. And it was with Turn that I moved over to the US, spent a year in San Francisco, then moved to LA, which was 9 years now. And then ultimately headed up strategy for brands like Toyota, Red Bull, Adidas, Kraft, Disney, overseeing their kind of digital, social, programmatic, CTV, digital out of home media. And then got my green card through them. And that was my ability to, okay, I'm safe in the US. I don't have to stay at this company, as great as they were. So I set up Mint, actually built Mint on the side for about a year while still working at that agency. Joined full-time 3 years ago, always with the vision of full-service performance marketing. I think one of my biggest disillusions working with brands of that size was like achieving the level of inefficiency from a performance and vendor standpoint was just staggering, you know. Like your performance teams are split by branded search, non-branded search, retargeting, Facebook, every other channel, and they never talk, and the creative agencies have nothing to do with distribution, and even internally at those agents, at those companies and some of the agencies we'd work with, it was all so fragmented. It was like, how is this the best way to run marketing? So it was a combination of that and then also like wanting to have more impact, right? So when you're working with brands of that size, it's like you have 50 million to spend and just spend it, because if you don't, you won't get it next year. And you could make some inroads into performance, but really, do you see what I mean? It was difficult to elicit too much change. So yeah, that was the kind of founding reason for Mint to work with brands where you could drive real outcomes and offer a more of a full service acquisition retention kind of service.
Amazing. Is that and how long did that run until you started talking to Flystory and Steven and then the acquisition? Because it feels like it was a fairly quick turnaround, like a few years. Like you said, it's 3 years in total, so maybe like 2 years in or something. Like how did that move into that?
The slightly longer version of the story around that is when Steve and Ol were still at Social Chain, I reached out to Ol. Because it's interesting, because Mint was a performance agency for DTC brands. So we did something very different to Social Chain, which was social strategy. It's all noise, engagement, cool creative, big brand stuff. But I think anyone in that industry, and maybe especially at the time, people with a connectivity to the UK, Social Chain were, you know, dare I say, somewhat groundbreaking in their approach. And then as Steven's profile rose, you know, just a really smart thinker, really sharp entrepreneur, really sharp at social. I reached out to Ol actually just on an Instagram DM after seeing him talk at a social marketing talk in LA whilst he was still at Social Chain. And we had coffee, and he actually paved the way for us getting a small level of investment from Social Chain, which led to us somewhat joining forces for a short period of time. And then I kind of helped Social Chain in the US as well with some activities. Yeah. All actually left about a month later. and he was really the conduit for wanting to do something. Because it was the idea of like, well, you work with big brands, we work with DTC brands, there's got to be some interconnectivity to kind of combine all these things. So, you know, that was a small level of investment, kind of like a partnership with Social Chain. And then I stayed in touch with Ol. And then it was about this time last year where we got back together again in New York, I think it was. And he was kind of explaining Flystory and what they were building, you know, really trying to build an agency group for the future. There's lots of agency groups that just make lots of acquisitions, but there's no interconnectivity. They're just very siloed. And the one thing that they were kind of missing was like a true growth marketing or marketing division, right? So they kind of have a comms content Web3 company, and so it felt like a really seamless slotting in of now something to actually manage performance media distribution into what they were doing. So kind of met with him and Steve, just so much alignment in our philosophies to building companies, building teams and marketing. It just felt like the right way to kind of associate myself and where I wanted to take Mint at the time, which was you know, a little bit out of the arbitrage, commoditize, we run ads, we send emails, and really establish ourselves as being growth partners for businesses. And not just your DTC, not that we don't go after those or like work with a lot of those, but not just those types of businesses, right? We wanna we wanna think of ourselves as a growth partner. And whatever your growth challenge is, whatever type of business you are, we have a solution for that.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I love that. I think there's such a crossover, it's a cliche to say, right, that it's like growth and growth and like pay media is one and the same in a lot of agencies. You go and you're signing a growth retainer, but really what you're signing is just a retainer that you would get at any performance marketing agency. But there are very few agencies that do dig into like what is the actual growth challenge here, it might not just be running ads. It might be all the other million things that go that kind of sit under that umbrella. And I think it's really good when an agency presents themselves as, we're your growth partner, we know what you need to do, or we'll help you understand what you need to do or work out what you need to do, and then we'll do it. We won't just say, cool, we're going to turn on Meta for you next week and say that that is where your growth engine is.
Yeah. And I think like one of the evolutions, especially this year, has been leaning into that even more, right? Which is, we have quite a few clients where we're not even doing the executional work. They have in-house teams. What we're doing them is showcasing a different way of thinking, right? So it's almost acting as either, I hate to say the phrase because we don't position ourselves in this way, but like an outsourced CMO, right? Mm-hmm. We're not mm-hmm. saying we do that. We're saying we're growth strategists and creative strategists. So we have the capabilities to do the execution, and we do that for about 80% of our business. But we also work with brands mm-hmm. where it's like, we just want a different perspective, right? We want someone who understands how to move us through the gears of growth.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's, you know, there's going from one to two, but then two to three, three to four. And you need someone potentially with the experience of doing that, that also is able to look at more data points than just the insular, my brand, my data, my way of thinking, my team's way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the real benefit of working with agencies, right? Like, you think of, why does any brand work with an agency? In an earlier stage, it's like, well, because I don't want to or can't hire in-house, right?
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, I need better performance. And then at a larger scale, it's, I want different ways of thinking and people who have more insight into a broader spectrum of marketing or the ecosystem than just my in-house team, but you're complementary to them.
Yeah, I love that. I think it's often a pushback, right? That I even heard it today on a call. It's like, we could, my option is go with an agency and have a retainer, or just go and hire like a growth lead internally. And I think exactly you nailed it really, Daniel. It's like, you could do that, but that person only has the insight of maybe some stuff they did in the past, probably, but then what they're doing in your company right now, whereas you go to an agency and you have a whole team that is working across, you know, 5-10 different projects that are probably vastly different from your specific business, and they're taking learnings from all of those and feeding them into all of the projects that they're working on. I think that's just an important thing to keep in mind.
Yeah.
Is there any challenges to that, having your approach in growing the agency and finding the talent, to have that different like that growth mentality that is not necessarily like channel focus or like an expert into something? Like, does that mean you have to look for, I don't know, different type of skill sets or profile? Like, how do you go about that to be able to fulfill the vision?
Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, we obviously have, we still have executional specialists, so we still have paid media, like we still have that. I'd say when we're talking about that growth piece, we have a great team who have built up, like, I hate to, again, a playbook, right? Of like, how do we do this? What's our approach as an agency? Which, let's be honest, is really important, because you can't have everybody doing everything slightly different, right? There's customization and nuance based on the brand. But how we go about doing it, which has been really successful for us, is somewhat built out. So finding the talent, I think, actually, in my opinion, like finding and hiring growth strategists and training growth strategists is really exciting for people as a potential, because I'm not saying every marketer wants to go this route, but a lot of marketers want to ultimately or potentially become more rounded, right? So if you only focus on one channel, right, that's good, but you know, there's a potential ceiling, right, of like how much you can grow as a Meta paid media buyer or as a purely lifecycle marketing, potentially. Don't get me wrong, like, people do really well at it. So the opportunity and positioning as we're hiring, right, is this could set you up to be the future CMO of a brand. Right, you're going to get so much exposure to different challenges, where maybe they, as a strategist, they understand the data, the roadmap, how to analyze, but they're not so familiar with the execution. They're going to get insight into the execution, right? Of like how to do those things, how to influence it, how to pull the different levers, across paid, influencer, website, lifecycle marketing.
Yeah.
So I think like finding people where they have that base understanding of e-commerce and strategy, training them, but also the future is this could set you up to be a future CMO. As you think, like it's a more compelling potential career trajectory than being just a channel specialist, because those channel specialists can also evolve into growth strategists should they have the, you know, desire and capability to do so.
For sure, yeah, for sure. I think it's there's something there that I think about a lot when we talk about, well, we talk about growth a lot in this podcast and at work and everything. I think the more you get exposed to other channels or other ways of growing online, offline, whatever it is, you get trained. You can get very good at connecting the dots between things. And that's where I think a lot of the unlock is done sometimes for, and it's very specific to, you know, every business is different. But you, it's like you're able to solve like a 1,000-piece puzzle in 30 seconds, whereas the team in place would take 2 years.
Yeah.
Like you can do it very quick because you know that the life cycle marketing this way with the website plus the ads, like you can, you see like a few steps ahead basically.
Yeah.
And I think about that sometimes. Like I think that's the muscle you train yourself to get really good at. And that's really useful for other businesses for sure.
And I think agencies provide a, if I'm honest with you, provide a good stepping stone for people who want to do that. Right? Because it's sometimes thrown at agencies as maybe a negative in one way, but like if you're a good agency, what do you have to be good at? You have to really train your teams to be efficient, efficient and effective at knowing the right things to look at quickly to provide value to your client quickly. So to your point, you get really trained on what are the right things to look for. And the more you do that, and then you make assessments around, okay, well, I need to therefore do this, 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 this to fix it. Does that make sense? Like you can come to those conclusions kind of quicker. So like a good agency is training their teams on what to look for and then how to influence those things to drive a net positive outcome. And that's, you get more exposure to the nuances of those challenges when you're looking at multiple brands over the time that you're working at an agency.
Exactly.
I love that.
That's really cool. And then obviously what Jake, what you are saying, and then the team also, because it's exposed to multiple clients, you share learnings across different industries, different type of businesses, and that's also very valuable for the new clients that you bring in, because they get that knowledge instantly. And I think, so to put that in parallel with working in-house, that's also one of the reason why I know me personally, I wanted to do the podcast again, is because when you're in-house for a long time, what can happen, not to everyone, is that you become really isolated to your business and to what you do. And sometimes you can go really far. It's like to the point where everyone in the team is like, you know, in a box, and then things start to feel a bit slow and you make less decisions, you become less innovative and stuff. And doing this, and I know it's the same for you with your podcast, is like a way for me to every week talk to someone new about something.
Yeah.
About growth.
Yeah.
And just, you know, keeps me sharp, and gets you thinking always outside of the box of your, you know, your business, your startup. So
yeah, as 100%. That's definitely why, it's definitely one of the motivations for the podcast on my side as well. And I think it's, you know, probably by nature, like as growth marketers, you're positioned to always think of how you can improve something. Right, because your job is to constantly improve a metric, so you're constantly seeking new information, and that can, like to your point, a lot of that comes from different perspectives. I think I've gained so much knowledge from doing Bite Size, of just talking to people and just different perspectives of how to frame or think about a challenge or an opportunity is super beneficial.
Yeah, it's really good.
Nice.
Me and Yo's WhatsApp group is mad. I think the benefit of doing it with someone else is that you can, like with everything, right? You can kind of throw ideas around. And, you know, today there was like three, I mean, he's got a crippling hangover today, but I bombarded him with like three ideas and he's like, I just can't process this right now. But you're completely right. You're always looking for what's that next thing that's going to kind of move the needle, or what's that thing that we want to experiment with. Or when we talk to someone on the podcast, they say something, you're like, oh shit, you know, we need to start doing that. Or how can we twist that into what we do? Mm. So it's exactly as we've said, it's almost like having a podcast is very similar to the experience of working in an agency, where you get to talk to people that are on very different projects to you and share ideas. You know, it's a similar kind of thing. It's just like learning from each other, and you don't necessarily get that in-house. And yeah, you can definitely end up feeling stuck when you're in-house. And also another good thing about an agency is that sometimes you have to work on things that you would never have, you know, applied. Yeah. You would never have applied to be like the head of growth at I don't know what, like some kind of weird thing that comes across your lap and you're like, okay, now I've got to try and make this work. And that's fun, right? You learn different things when you're at your comfort zone.
Yeah.
I just want to double back on that crippling hangover on a Wednesday point. Like, what was your Tuesday night?
I a few months ago, I booked a ticket to see a concert in Dalston of a rapper from, I think, from LA. Well, he's from Atlanta, but he lives in California. He's, do you know Zach Fox?
I don't, I'm afraid. I'm into my metal and my guitar music, so I'm not.
So, yeah, I went to see a rap concert last night, and it was a boozy one. So, yeah, it was pretty good. It was pretty good. The guy's talented. I'm glad. I'm glad I saw him. So, shout out, Zach Fox, if you're listening to this. The concert was great. So I wanted to ask you, going back to the agency world, are you surprised by what you get asked by clients when they come in versus what you offer, or your expectation of what you're going to be able to do with them?
There's a few ways to answer that question, because there's a couple of different perspectives around it. I mean, first and foremost, I think even since I started the agency, the fundamental ask from brands is different these days, right? Mm. It used to be, and maybe that's because our positioning has changed. So I'm a bit conscious of like, has the ask changed or has our positioning evolved?
Yeah,
right.
Okay.
But so it might be a combination of the two. But, you know, I think whereas it felt like it used to be a bit more, and probably with all the changes within the ecosystem, it was like, run our ads, send our emails, right? Everything mm-hmm. else will take care of itself. Now it's far more about the strategy, right? That both being the roadmap of growth, but also obviously creative strategy. We get asked a lot more about creative strategy, and that wasn't really as much in the conversation 3 years ago. Mm. Which I think makes sense, right? That's where the industry has changed.
And what specifically about creative strategy?
You know, it's interesting.
What do they want?
Yeah. So this is both from talking to all the brands, talking to people on the podcast, but also, you know, small subsection, but doing some polls out there as well. It's really interesting because it's less about I need someone to edit the video, put the overlay on. They want the thinking. They want the strategic thinking of, okay, what should we actually be saying? And then, based on the results, how do we evolve that? And then what's the future state? And then how does we have an approach where your performance creative copy testing should influence brand, should influence the website, right? You can test some of those things as part of your creative testing or your funnel testing. It's less about, do you have a team that can do graphic design and video editing? Because again, that's a commodity, right? It's good to be able to have it because you streamline everything. And as I mentioned earlier, the goal is to not have to work with multiple people, but it's far more about the strategic thinking, like persona development. How does that correlate into my creative strategy? So it's more the strategic aspect of it.
Yeah, I see. Do you also manage talent, like influencers or creators, or do you have like in-house ones too to provide
Combination of both. Yeah, so we work with influencers being people with natural influence, right? So influencer partnerships. Yeah. And then we do work with creators as well. So we have a roster of creators that we work with just to provide ad creative or landing page creative and stuff like that.
That is a good point, because when in this room, in this podcast, when we talk about influencers and creators, we know what we're talking about. Like, it makes sense. Like, we think influencers with influence, big, probably one-off videos, maybe a little set of videos. And then creators is more like, you know, they don't necessarily have a following, but they know how to make content.
Yeah.
And they can make maybe more of it or more variations or things like that.
Yeah.
But that is not a given for 99% of the people outside of the marketing world. Like, I always have to explain myself. Like, but Johan, what do you mean? Like, who's that person? Yeah. Is she famous? Is he famous? I'm like, no. So that's, you know, he's 19 or he's 20 and he just makes really fucking good videos.
Yeah.
He doesn't have any following, but he doesn't have any followers. And I'm like, oh gosh. Like, do you get a lot of that or?
Yeah, definitely.
Or not really?
No. I think a while ago, especially when the word creator and creator economy started becoming so popular, everyone knew of influencer marketing, right? So I think it's one of my best performing LinkedIn posts, which was just like, to clear it up, an influencer has influence, i.e. we are trying to tap into the people who follow them, right? Through a partnership, through whitelisting, through whatever. A creator, to your point, is just someone who creates really good content. So typically it's like you're going to find fewer, more high impactful influencers, and you're going to find the width of creative that you might need through a creator. So but still to this day the phrases influencers and creators gets muddled up multiple times within a given paragraph by a lot of people, which
I understand.
It's confusing, right?
It is confusing. It is, you know. Good to know.
I had a few messages from people at various points during the podcast and a request to have more discussion with people that started an agency and the process, maybe not the process of starting an agency, but the process of going from maybe where you're just working with a few clients and you're effectively just like a freelancer or a consultant to taking it to that next step and becoming an agency. I wonder if you can talk a bit, Daniel, about how you did that or any tips around making that transition or just general thoughts around that.
Yeah. I want to be careful of applying hindsight clarity to overshadow the reality of what actually happened. Does that make sense?
Because
I, you know, having done it and gone from, you know, one person to now we're, you know, 50 plus people. I think at the time, right, I was working with a couple of clients and it got to the point where I was kind of doing too much, right? So I was doing too much and thought there's an opportunity here based on the clients to start fulfilling that vision of being full service. So I had a rough understanding of paid media. It started with paid media influencer and email, actually as an agency. So I think like most people will have an understanding of the framework they want to build out. I think where most people will struggle is how do I hire people? How do I scale those people? At what point do I hire people, right? I think the landswell of agencies right now, and not all of them, but push towards kind of will get cheap executional talent to maximize my margins, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one approach. It's not the approach that I took. I took more of an approach of, I always want to really prioritize customer retention or client retention, excuse me, and results. And so I hired the best people I could at the time. And I think that's one thing to note as you're scaling an agency, right? Even though I'd had a successful career doing this within this ecosystem of building companies and working with these types of brands, I wasn't like well known or kind of had that at that time, that deep network. So I think if there's any advice for people kind of at that stage, and I actually do some consulting with other agency owners and kind of help around this, it's I think building and hiring into the framework you think is going to support your growth and deliver the best value early is really important. But I think too many people get hung up on, well, I can't hire the best person. And that's probably okay if you're like a year in, right? Because the best people might not want to go to an agency who's a year old and has 5 clients. Yeah. But I think the foundation and building out those systems and processes early helps you go through those gears of who you can bring into the agency that up levels you with each time you do that based on how you're performing as an agency. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
It definitely does. And what, during that initial process, did you find the most difficult, or where did you, I'm not saying at any point ever like all fell apart, but was there a point where there was challenges, and what was the biggest challenge there?
If any entrepreneur says there wasn't a time where it almost fell apart, there's probably about 50. When you're early on, I think any big client loss or any key hire leaving feels existential, right? Because a senior talented team member leaving, you think, my clients are going to leave me because this person is leaving, because they're here. Do you know what I mean? They're here because of that. And I think that's a natural worry. And then any big client loss, obviously, is always a challenge. I don't think we ever struggled on the client side, because we've always done really well from referrals and network. You know, we've never had a sales team. It's all come as a byproduct of just the work that we've done. I think one of the most challenging moments is when, you know, in hindsight, it was the right time and it actually allowed me to up level the people that I had within the agency. But when a couple of more senior people left, natural progression of their careers, right? But that felt really challenging at the time, because they were doing the work, they were owning the client relationships. And I was like, how am I going to transition these key people out of the business, replace them with people? I think at that point, I'd built up enough of a network and reputation for the work that we were doing. And I've always had a really good sense as to what the vision and mission of the agency is, which I think really helps when you're trying to attract talent. You know, people get excited by, well, where are we going? What do we want to achieve that's different to just come and have a job here because we have ongoing and we'll pay you a bit of money and so I think being able to sell people on that vision, or just having real conviction as to what that mission and vision is and how we want to operate as a company, what felt like an existential crisis at the time was actually an up-leveling moment when I look back in hindsight now. I remember what I felt like for that 4-week period, and it was we're fucked, because we were early. That's when we're like, you know, 12 people or something. And I hear a lot of people, you know, kind of say that, right? As talent leaves the agency, especially when you're younger and you don't have maybe different resources and everything else to pull from. I think as long as you can try and use those as a way to either make structural changes that maybe you wanted to make but couldn't because you had people filling certain positions, or you use it as a way of up-leveling and bringing in better talent, I think sometimes those can be the forced things that actually help you up-level.
So has that vision changed, like the vision now is versus what it was when you started? Has that kind of evolved over time, or has it always been the same? And could you remind us what that is?
It's definitely, it's evolved as we've matured, but it's a constant refinement and up-leveling of the initial vision, which is we want to be the growth partner that accelerates brands and offer full service capabilities to be able to support that, right? That's always been the vision and the mission. I think the evolution has come, one, as a foresight into what brands are wanting, like I said, which is what guides the execution to a point where it's really successful is the strategy, right? So it's evolved to be more and more of that strategic piece, right? Whereas initially it was full service, but very executional. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's now like strategy now really guides execution, whereas it used to be we're just very good at executing the channels. Mm-hmm. But it's the same kind of core mission.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. What is the number one thing that you've been advising the clients that you work with, growth wise, or the kind of maybe the trend lately in the last 12 months across all the channels and everything that's possible?
Yeah, I think two core things, which I think is well known to us as marketers, but you know, brands start brands because they're great at product development, and do you see what I mean? Like there's a different skill set broadly. Yeah. So as much as we've been maybe saying this for a while, and I'll argue that creative has always been the variable, it's you really have to think about your creative. And that doesn't mean just investing more money into production. It means your positioning, your angles, your personas that support it, your messaging, right? So really educating on the importance of creative. And I think maybe there's two other things. One has been a lot of, it's actually education on when to channel diversify versus when to focus on core channels, right? I think we went through a period, especially when Facebook was having challenges post iOS 14, that kind of hung on for a while of, oh, well, let's test TikTok, let's do this, let's do this, let's do this. So education on channel mix, I think, is a big one. And then for us, it's really understanding the balance between acquisition and retention and the importance of that, right? And I think a lot of, we talk about retention marketing, lifecycle marketing. I still think the vast majority of brands think that that's just sending emails and flows. Right? So it's a deeper level of understanding around what does actual lifecycle and retention marketing mean? We kind of have a model, you know, which I help frame, I think helps frame this up of like scale and sustain. It's like scaling the brand through acquisition, through kind of brand marketing is one thing, but it's the sustainability of repeat customers and your lifecycle marketing efforts and everything else that really pays dividends. So those are, I think those are the three most common things that we're educating around. I think probably the biggest one has been the creative, the importance of creative.
Very interesting. Yeah. No, that makes sense. Very cool.
Well, just on that, when you work with a client, do you kind of stipulate that the creative has to be an element of it when they come in and say, we just want a growth retainer with you guys. We have creative, we'll give you the creative, whatever. Do you guys feel like you need to have more ownership of running that in-house to execute in the way that you want to and kind of test in the way that you want to?
Not necessarily always the execution, but the ideation, yes. Yeah. We end up doing a lot of the execution because we have a kind of full creative team. Yes, in actual fact, if you're running paid media with us, you get creative strategy. It's a requirement. Paid media creative strategy is one.
Yeah.
In terms of like how you look to work with us.
If you want to control the outcome, the only variable right now, even more than before, is the creative. So if you don't have control of that, then you can't really guarantee improvements, I guess. So you do have to have
comes
with it.
If you're coming to an agency like us, you're looking to drive an outcome which is better efficiencies at greater scale, right? And so if we're pulling levers within ad platforms, you know, I don't want to deprecate the importance of great media buyers and the analytical thinking, but there's only so much you can do with that, right? So I totally agree.
What is the talking about creative, what's the new trend? What's the best type of creative that's working right now,
you know,
across your portfolio?
static image carousels. No. I mean, I'm only half joking.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You know what's? Do you know what the interesting thing about that is? Listen, everyone wants a new angle because I don't want to sound kind of jaded by it, but everyone wants a new angle to showcase that they have a different way of thinking. I don't think it's about that. I don't think it's about whether it's a video, a UGC, a carousel, a static image. I think the real magic comes from when you find the messaging that resonates with the different personas you're going after. And whether that's a video or a carousel, that will change based on the auction. It will change on all those things. And so I don't really care about that as much. That will take care of itself. What doesn't just take care of itself is thinking differently based on who am I trying to acquire as a customer, where do they spend their time, and what are all the different variables I can do to try and attract them, and which one is the best, and then double down on that. You know, and I think, like, for us as well, we're kind of bridging that gap now more and more between, you know, yes, performance DR, kind of like direct acquisition ads and creative, but what helps that the most, and Johan, we spoke about this in the Bite Size podcast, you know, how can we support those acquisition efforts through broader, kind of more brand marketing, right? And like, again, my big thing for starting the agency is brand and performance. It's one thing. It's a funnel. The fact that it used to be so separate is or was insane to me. But that can
happen. Brandformance.
Okay. Is that trademarked?
No. So, like, yeah, I've started to hear it from Gary Vee in the last 2 weeks, two, 3 weeks. I've missed the new word. It's brandformance.
Brandformance. He needs to refine that a little bit, I'll be honest with you. We can do better.
It's not the best.
But it's true. Yeah. You know, it's true. And you know this. I think at certain levels of scale, you're going to have that. And I'd also argue, and a lot of people do argue, right? Brands who think about that earlier than other brands are going to have an easier growth trajectory than brands that don't. Now, listen, there's always certain types of brands or products that don't. If you're a commoditized, if you're selling spoons, or, you know, just what I mean, like, or toasters or something like that, do you need to build a brand around that? Maybe not. But for the clients we work with, they're trying to build brands, right? They're not just trying to sell commoditize things online. They're trying to build brands for the future. So, you know, we're doing a lot more when it comes to that. And it's where we're using influencers more. Whereas it went very influencers, just put them in ads and do that. Yes, we do that as a portion, but I think using influencers and other types of creative and kind of channel distribution to aid your lower funnel is super beneficial. I also think, sorry to drag this answer on too long, you know, there was a big, when we started the agency, organic social media was something that a lot of brands wanted. And then no one gave a shit about it, right? Because, like, just post a picture a day, who cares? Organic reach has gone down the toilet, like, why do we care? And now I think with the rise of TikTok and organic reach, YouTube Shorts, these sorts of things, it's like the landswell of attention you can get from organic social. And you think about touch points for a consumer and a brand they care about, I think it's super beneficial to invest time, energy, resources into that sort of thing. So, you know, again, this is where the strategists really come into play, is like all those different touch points and what a brand should be doing. You can't do it all now, right? Every brand has a budget, but I think organic social plays a big part, or should be playing a big part.
Yeah, I think on the whole brand performance side of things, like if you think of all the brands or products that we're seeing on the daily, like all of us will be seeing, you know, like Whoop, Peloton, Zoe, all of these big scaling brands that pretty much everybody has heard of, they are running optimized performance activity. They're all of those ads that you're seeing that have grown your awareness of those companies as brand, Monday.com, you know, they're all measuring CAC, and they're all optimizing those to an end result. None of those are just running brand only campaigns, yet they have managed to build a brand with it. So, like, what more of a case study do you need? any ad that you see all the time and you click and it takes you to a landing page where they're trying to sell you something are building a brand through performance marketing.
I'm a real fan of simplicity, right? Forget everything. If none of us knew anything, right, and you were launching a brand, it is that funnel. Your lower funnel, you need the most optimized lower funnel as possible. But what is that there to do? It's to capture the intent and everything else that you're building through broader awareness, right? You can only scale that so far. And yes, that can actually go very far, but it's the smaller part. So if you only do that and you don't focus on the stuff that trickles down into that, or if you don't try and get the stuff, the brand awareness to trickle down, right? That makes no sense. It actually makes no sense to me. It's not to say you can't be very successful just scaling lower funnel. You can. You can get to decent revenue numbers from doing. But you will help yourself if you think of things in a way of like, well, what can I also be doing to drive mass awareness, increase those touch points, and organic social and those sorts of things. I say free, right? It's not super free because you've got to pay for the talent and content production, but that's a lot cheaper than like, you know, running a Super Bowl ad or something like that.
I want to go back to what you said about organic social. Back then was probably one of the biggest opportunities as an agency owner. Then it kind of died down and now it's back. Like, it's, I agree. I think there's not company, but very few companies are geared up to the amount of content they need to be putting out on these platforms every day.
Yeah.
No one does enough.
No.
And if they do, they still do it the old way, which is they just post once a day on Instagram. It gets 5 likes and they just do it because their team internally is being measured on, did you post today on Instagram?
Yeah.
Yes. Tick. You know, and there is no thinking more like behind that. So I think I agree. There's a massive opportunity again for solving that problem for brands, but also I see creators like, you know, literally kids building up like mini creator agencies, like 2 or 3 of them, and they would just go and knock on everyone's door and be like, oh. We'll do your TikToks every day. Like, we'll do 5 a day, you know, like, and they just machine and they just churn out ideas.
Yeah.
And I think it's about changing your thinking and as a brand trying to find the people like this. And on the other side, if you're a creator or if you're an agency and want to be an agency around that, explaining that to brand that that's what they need to do, and then just offering out to them, like, I think it's massive, because that's where the performance will be plugged into as well. If you up the level of content going out, whatever's popping that day, hopefully you'll get one success or a few success in a month. That's your ad, and then that becomes your ad, and it just does both.
A really interesting thing for me was, even if I apply that to like the agency, right? For us to grow and scale, we sign more clients, right? Although we're pretty specific about the types of brands that we work with. But it's like, you know, if I'd have started running ads, right, for the agency, targeting brand owners and optimized my lower funnel, and we tested it to a degree, and questionable in terms of whether it attracted the right types of people, versus this year posting every day, if not twice a day, on LinkedIn, building up an organic social following, doing the same on Twitter. That's been far more impactful for the types of interest we get around the brand. And I think that same methodology that grows personal brands and everything else, if you apply that to a consumer facing brand, it's like, it's kind of the same thing. We have a good optimized lead form on our website, a good onboarding sales process, blah blah blah, but it's like that land swell of content. So for us, it's thought leadership, it's, you know, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I agree. And it's often that we'll say to brands that we are working with, like, take out a portion of the budget you are planning to spend on paid media and put it into content. And I think there's a huge opportunity for brands when it comes to content syndication across the many, many different platforms. And when we talk about channel diversification, I think from an ad spend perspective, it's where you need to be very focused. But from an organic perspective, right, it's, you mentioned him, it's the Gary V kind of, I can't remember what he called it, shoot once and syndicate. I think more, you know, I'd be really interested to see the results if more brands put far more effort into that organic content syndication piece.
Yeah, we'll see. It usually takes a, like I've been in the last 10 years, I've been very surprised of how slow things go, brand side, very slow. So it might still take 5 years. We'll see.
So question for you, being brand side, do you think that just comes down to it's harder to measure the impact?
I think it's, yeah, it's harder to measure because a lot of brands still wants to silo attribute everything down to the ROI of that day.
Yeah.
And that kills, you know, half of your ideas right there. The other thing is the growth, marketing, whatever teams internally are not set up for the amount, the volume of content that needs to be put out. They don't have the right processes. And like I said earlier, they're not, the quality of their work is not measured on the right things.
Yeah.
They don't have the right KPIs. And sometimes there's also a knowledge problem where the person running the social media channels are not necessarily clued up with the growth aspect of them. You know, like they might not be in that consuming that content or, you know, this kind of podcast like this one. Or so there's a knowledge gap, a reporting gap, and then a KPI gap.
Yeah.
Where they just don't look at the right metrics, or they don't think quantity is one of the metrics.
Yeah.
They'll just do, you know, like I said, one a day. And not even look at engagement. They kind of gave up. And then it's set up that way. And yeah, it's a bit... And I think that makes it... I think I'm making it sound like it's easy. It's not easy. I understand it's hard.
Yeah, for sure.
Because when you have to change the fiber of your teams internally, especially if you're a big brand with like hundreds of employees... And maybe that's impacting 30 people, and you have to tell them like you're not doing your job like that now. You have to do it like that.
Yeah.
And like imagine the egos and like you're telling me like you know what I mean. Like I think you're creating a lot of shit when you do that. So so I understand it's hard. It's difficult to change mentalities and on these three kind of variables that I mentioned.
Yeah, I agree.
I think often a brand, like especially a startup brand, can one of the first things they do is they put together their brand guidelines and they decide what they are as a brand. And then that hinders when they actually want to do something. They want to experiment with stuff and they're like, we want to do all this crazy experimentation, but you know, I'm talking this way. They have to do this kind of, and I'm completely on board with brand guidelines, but I think there needs to be some flex involved. If you want to be doing, you want to be testing and experimenting stuff, and that gets in the way a lot, I find.
Yeah, I think that what's on brand versus what's not on brand, and don't get me wrong, there's definitely guardrails there, but I think I agree with you. I think there's far too much restrictions, especially early on, right? Because you might have your, I think there's. And it's not wrong thinking because you've got to start from somewhere, but I think there's an aspirational and then there's the reality.
Yeah.
And I think if there's not a willingness to accept the reality and allow it to infiltrate how you think and talk and show up in the world as a brand, I think it's a limiting factor.
I'll give you an example to this. Which I've seen in the past. It's been a few years, but you'll understand how stupid it is. When you have brand guidelines with specific typeface or font or whatever, and that is going to be a reason why you would not use the font on Instagram stories or TikTok because it's not the font of your brand. So you will not, won't allow your team to write overlays, text on top of the content native to the platform because it's not your brand and you don't want to like, you know, you're like nobody that just started that no one knows. And you're like kind of like fighting against. You're like, oh, I'm not, you know, giving up to TikTok. I'm not giving up to Instagram. It's like, come on, man.
Yeah.
So that's like as an extreme example, but I've seen it, and I had to have this discussion, and I was like,
oh,
I can't believe we're talking about this.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't doubt it. That is a fundamental lack of understanding of how to leverage platforms and drive engagement.
And the reason why I'm saying this, I guess, to finish the point, is like if you're shooting yourself in the foot from out of the gate, like you're not going to allow yourself to utilize the platform to the best of their ability to get the reach and the potential virality and the customer outcome, the business outcome that you're looking for, because you are so strong on your brand guidelines. So it's stupid.
I think that that's one of the challenges with creative as well, because how many brands have such a broad and non-specified idea as to who their customer profile is, right? Like if I'm a drinks brand, well, everyone drinks, so everyone is my target consumer. Where some of the cases I've seen the best results for brands where they're in the earlier stage, right, where maybe that's not as defined, is actually breaking down very specific personas and having very tailored creative and landing page environments for them.
Mm-hmm.
If it is a product that is actually really quite broad in its potential.
Mm-hmm.
I think I think there's too much genericism, if that's a word, generic.
Yeah, whatever. That sounds good.
Either version of that word, around that thinking that then infiltrates into really generic ad creative, right?
Yeah.
I don't ever want to see a supplement brand or something like that say powered by science ever again.
Yeah. I think looking at B2B, they do that really well. They've segmented out all of the people and they speak to them differently. They have a custom landing page, the ads specifically target them. I don't think enough kind of D2C brands do that. But then coming back to your point about expectation and reality, I think that's really important, because a lot of times we probably all work with founders and CEOs where their vision of what they want to build or what they imagine it being is actually hindering the growth. Because what the data is showing doesn't align with their dream. And I think that's just a really stupid place to be, because I'm a big fan of research. I love doing research, but I think you always have to build personas with the expectation that they are going to flex over time when you actually start working out.
Yeah.
You like your shit.
And if it makes brands, you know, even the biggest brands still have that challenge. And I actually remember working with Toyota. And we were held against some crazy metrics, if I'm honest with you, but you know, one of their things was like, they wanted us, it was like adults were buying the cars for their kids, but they wanted to directly prove that kids were buying the, or children, or you know, the younger generation. Is the wrong word. It's like, no, we specifically want to see them as the purchasing demographic. And I was like, why? we already know that, you know, we could advertise to the younger, the adults would still buy it, would do this. Do you know what I mean? Like, we actually had to, or the suggestion was, well, that's your aspiration as to what you want to achieve. So because we were held accountable to certain results, we carved that off and we had to grow that as a percentage increase as to that being the direct consumer, even though it made no sense. So, you know, all this stuff, it can sometimes sound like as marketers we're kind of and I know we're not, we're just discussing, but critiquing brands for not thinking this way, but it's hard, right? And it like, and it changes. And I think, you know, you made a good point there of, you sometimes have to fail in a couple of areas of testing, right? To really double down on and have data to support your convictions to who you think you want to be going after and how to kind of scale that.
Amazing.
Right. I'm looking at the time. I don't want to take too much of your time, Daniel. It's been an hour and almost 10 minutes. If people wants to connect with you, find you, talk to you, where should they do it?
LinkedIn. Just search for Daniel James. And then, as one of the worst personal brand moves on Twitter, I am foodog85, which is FOODOG85. I told you I like Japanese culture, and I've got two foodogs tattooed on my chest. But yeah, Twitter, foodog85, LinkedIn, Daniel James.
Nice, love that. I feel like these handles should come back. I might change mine from my name to something like that.
I think you need
to be, you need to be like Frog Dog with your two samurai frogs that you've got tattooed on your car, on your thigh.
I do have a tattoo on my chest as well. We're very similar, Daniel. Yeah. I have a fox and a monkey in like manga,
well,
Japanese
style. I expect to see a Twitter handle refresh after this podcast.
That was amazing. Thank you, Daniel, for your time and sharing your insights, your knowledge. That was awesome. A West Coast to East Coast, well, East Europe.
Yeah. My absolute pleasure. Fun. You guys are doing awesome stuff. I absolutely love the podcast. So really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you, man.
No, pleasure's all ours, Daniel. All right. It's been wicked.
Thanks, guys.